We are often told that we live in Hollywood North, the Canadian hub of film and TV, fueled by nice views, nice people, and parenthetically, bargain basement tax write-offs. But honestly, most of those creative industries are deep underground. The movies often cover their presence meticulously. The common phrase is Vancouver never plays itself, but inversely, the movies never play Vancouver. Maybe that's not clear. Let me explain. You almost never see filming occur. The signs a movie happened here always show up after the actual event, like a burglar leaving a monogrammed glove in the safe he just emptied. You'll be walking around somewhere downtown when suddenly an underground entrance to the New York subway appears right in front of you, here in Vancouver. You take a peek down and realize it's a staircase leading straight into the floor, like the Winchester Mystery House. A friend tells you, oh yeah, they wrapped filming on a remake of Taxi Driver. That's probably just a leftover. They're doing a remake of Taxi Driver, you ask? Why didn't anyone tell me? I like Taxi Driver. I could have given them some good ideas. But of course, they don't want your ideas. The movies hide themselves this way to make sure you don't give them your ideas. You head to a vending machine to drown your sorrows in soda, but then you realize all of the brands are fake. Dr. Papa, Orange Crasher, Diet Pepsi. It's not even a real vending machine. It's a prop left over from an episode of Arrow. Still, the lights are on and it's cold to the touch, so there must be something in there. You fish your pockets for catch, but you realize there's nothing in your pocket but a fake American 5. The words, motion picture use only, and in props we trust, encircle Abraham Lincoln's face. He is smiling, showing every one of his perfect gleaming white teeth. Oh, that's left over from a bank robbing scene, your friend tells you. They're making a sequel to Rififi. They're calling it Rofofo, or Rufufu, I don't remember. They're making a sequel to Rififi, you think? Why didn't anyone tell me? I wrote my master's thesis on Rififi. With nothing but fake money, stood in front of a fake dispenser after you just tried to enter a fake subway, there's nothing left to do but resign yourself. You put the prop $5 into the machine, which diligently swallows it, and you turn away. Then, totally against logic, the vending machine emits a heavy clunk as a fully branded can of Diet Pepsi rolls out, clean, shiny, and cold. You take it and sip on it as you walk to the nearest bookstore. A nagging anger sits in the back of your head. Why did this have to be the most delicious thing you ever tasted?
Anyone in danger?
Danger! Danger!
Danger.
Danger hasn't come home yet.
Hey everybody, welcome again. It's Infinite Danger episode 2, the second ever episode. Thank you very much for all your kind words for the first episode. I've been getting a lot of really good positive messages. I've had a lot of congratulations, a lot of people saying, welcome back to podcasting, Will. I've been waiting for it for you so long. I actually got like a few bouquets sent to my door, and that was really lovely. Thank you very much. I haven't actually uploaded the first episode. I've got to bank a lot of these just to make sure that I can get a pretty regular schedule. And I don't know. I was imagining what would happen when I put out the first episode, and that it made sense. Danger Bay, episode 2, Running Free, first aired 1984, October 15th, which coincidentally is actually the day that I'm recording this. I guess fortune is smiling down on me here. Interestingly, the production code is a little bit different here. The first episode we did was 01001, but we're actually skipping ahead production-wise into the sixth episode that they ever actually filmed. The reason that the production team would have to make this episode a little later than the others will probably become pretty self-evident. This is an interesting episode, and it is especially interesting when we compare it to the first one, because you know how last time I was talking to you about how Danger Bay is right off the bat trying to conglomerate so many different TV genres into what is basically a pure television syncretism. We had it simultaneously be a medical drama and a police drama, all despite being actually built around working at an aquarium, etc., etc. Well, this episode is solidifying that. They turned the show into a Western already. Honey on the hoof! They've already left their original grounds and are doing a total turnaround to make this into a Western.
I'm going to give you blind old Annabelle there and take you back wherever you come from.
I wasn't being grandiose when I said that Danger Bay is basically trying to be pure television. I think the words I used were, we are listening from television itself. And I mean, that's basically true. If you are going to have basically every TV convention thrown at you within two episodes, I think that there's something that bears paying attention to there. Another interesting note here that I should mention is that this episode is directed by Stuart Margolin. Now, Stuart Margolin, his peak as an actor is sort of before my time, but he is an Emmy Award winner, in fact, a double Emmy Award winner, for his role in The Rockford Files as a character called Angel.
Jimmy, old buddy, buddy, it's Angel. You know how they allow you one phone call? Well, this is it.
The titular Rockford had a lot of contacts with the underground, or the criminal underground, and Angel is one of those characters. He is basically a compulsive liar.
Just kill one of us. That would be even better, see?
You could do Jimmy now, and then I go around and I tell people, well, you don't cheat Chester Sierra, and then later on, if you wanted to scare more people, why, I'd be available for the engagement.
And he's not actually in every episode. He is like a character that will have episodes built around him, certainly, but he is not a regular character. And that seems to be a sort of Danger Bay theme. A lot of character actors making good, effectively. We have Stuart Margolin as a constant figure in TV, but never the star, getting to be a director. And we have Donnelly Rhodes, who was in a similar position, though he never won an Emmy. He gets to be the central figure for once.
Listen, Eddie Talaferro just gave me a hot tip on a class filly in the 8th out at Holly Park. Only trouble is I need 20.
He is an American actor, but because of how the Vancouver landscape works, Stuart Margolin was living in Salt Spring, which is in BC, while this was being filmed, so he was a pretty easy person to access. Now, I might be bigging this up a little bit by talking about Stuart Margolin's Emmys, because those are Emmys that he got as an actor, and he is not acting here, he's a director. And Stuart Margolin is a very prolific TV director, basically all the way till the end. But being a prolific television director a lot of times means you will direct a lot of good things, but by the nature of taking so many jobs, a lot of what you're doing is going to be things like Mary-Kate and Ashley, How the West Was Fun.
If you're born to ride, but you're stuck in the city,
which I suppose Margolin got a bunch of Western directing experience here by doing this episode before moving on to greater things like Mary-Kate and Ashley, How the West Was Fun. So right at the very start of the cold open, they make no bones about the fact that this is going to be a Western episode. It's all about horse rustlers. We see a big pack of wild horses getting corralled by a lot of modern-day cowboys, effectively. They're chasing them down with cars, chasing them down with their own horses, of course. And they've all got big fancy jean jackets on. One of them has a big American Eagle on the back of it, which is an interesting sort of mélange, if you will. There's a Canadian tuxedo with a bald eagle on it. The wrestlers chase the horses into basically a cul-de-sac with a fence around it. And we see the one rustler who is actually going to be given a name in this entire episode.
Lock him in, Becky.
Her name's Becky, and the camera follows her with a lot of documentary-style shakiness, which I think is probably a holdover from Saltzman's company starting off as a documentary company. Becky grabs a rope and just ties all the horses in, which seems really flimsy to me. I think, you know, horses are usually known for their leaping. I think they can get over a single bit of rope, but regardless, the camera pays a lot of attention to Becky emoting here, and Becky seems at least to be trying to be made a main character here. Now, parenthetically, Becky is played by Pat Margolin, who, as you might expect, is Stuart Margolin's wife. The thing that's kind of interesting here is that she's Pat Margolin in the credits, but it seems like she never actually went by Margolin anywhere else in her life. I think somebody in the editing booth was a little bitter about it, let's say.
Later, Becky, my love. Right now, you and me is going to do some scouting. Becky, my love. Becky, my love. Becky, my love.
But the rustlers, regardless of how flimsy this trap may or may not be, they start celebrating their new catch, and they start hooting and hollering in the most stereotypical cowboy way that you could think of. Before we go into the opening theme. Now, this seems to be a bit of a holdover from the usual American stereotypes of cowboys. We've got a lot of cattle in Canada, we've got a lot of herders, we've got a lot of horse breeders, etc., etc. But the usual sort of cowboy yippee-ki-yay sort of jokey approach to the job is very rare to actually see here. They don't actually talk like this up on this side of the border. The whole sort of woo, yee, yippee, that sort of stuff doesn't really happen in Canada. Usually Canadian ranchers say things like, I'm thrilled at this opportunity to synergize our training and skilling procedures to exploit our core competencies. By bringing these horses into BHC Holdings' branding ecosystem, we'll be better able to attend to vendor needs with an eye towards productivity and connectivity. So that's the usual sort of rancher lingo when you come up across the border. The intro plays, and again, what we're looking at is really running at odds with what this episode is going to be about. It's all aquatic, but we're mostly going to be in a lot of this episode is going to be finding excuses for why the aquarium guy is going to be fighting cattle rustlers. On the other side of the theme song, we've left the rustlers. They're not going to show up again for another 5 minutes or so. Instead, we've got Grant drowsily looking over his papers at the aquarium lab with a various neon beakers in front of him. And the opening pre-roll credits are still going. We see the guest stars' names, and Dale Wilson is a guest star. Now, good on him for getting a named credit right at the start, because he still is not that big of a name. He will be a big name later, but not in the way that you would expect. We'll probably get into that a little later. Evidently, his character is called Kramer in the credits, but that doesn't show up in the show. Only Becky, Stuart Margolin's wife, gets a named role out of all of these characters. Now, Dale Wilson has probably been picked for this episode because he has a lot of credits in Western TV movies. He's in a bunch of TV movies with names like Wild Horse Hank. He's in The Gunfighters. He's in something called Stone Fox, which I haven't seen, but the IMDb synopsis reads, Little Willie must win a dog sled race in order to save his grandfather's cattle ranch. You know, things like that. Also, he has an uncredited role in McCabe and Mrs. Miller, because Vancouver. I mean, everybody and their dog has an uncredited role in McCabe and Mrs. Miller somehow, if you live in Vancouver. Dale Wilson was also in a show called Ritter's Cove, which is about an air taxi service in British Columbia. And of course, Ritter's Cove has also gone on to be its own sort of massive multimedia property, but of course, Wilson didn't really have as huge a role in that, so he didn't get to share in the glow of being part of the Ritter's Cove cinematic universe. So, starting the episode off proper, we see Grant. He is dealing with a bunch of paperwork, and he seems to be about as sleepy and drowsy and sort of stumbling as he was at the start of the first episode. It's going to be a bit of a motif as we continue, I'm thinking. So he's doing his paperwork. He checks his cuff and realizes that his button is missing. And so he starts doing a sort of Blue's Clues, looking around the building, looking for this button. Starts going to a fish tank and asks the fish,
"Did you see my button?"
Just sort of entertaining himself. I'm sort of distracted during this scene, looking at the papers that are hung up in the background of his office. There's a child's drawing of a squid, which is kind of cute, but there's also a poster of a beluga making, in my broken modern brain, what can only read as a pogger's face to me, just looking directly at the camera, just going, you know, pog champ. Grant gives up on looking for his cuff button, and he just sticks the two sides of the cuff into an office stapler and just chunk, affixes them together. And the moment he does this, Hagenbeggs, George Dunbar, Hagenbeggs, the aquarium chief of police, of course, he makes the most wonderfully square comment. Oh, my niece would love that staple, if she'd call it high fashion. And to really just shout it to the back of the crowd how much of a square this character is, he goes,
"I think they call it punk."
The fact that he has to add this tag to it really is brilliant. It really hits home how much of a stick of a mud this character is. Grant's reply really just shows how joyfully lame both of them are in this moment.
"Well, I call it being in a hurry. My kids have been after me to update my wardrobe. You think that this will satisfy them?"
And as he walks off, I gotta say, after joyfully talking about how square you are, Grant, are those old New Balances paired with khakis that I spy? So now we finally get a bit of plot and expository dialogue. Effectively, the excuse for how we're going to move Grant from where he is here to a totally different biome, basically.
"I just got off the phone with fisheries. There's a problem with several of the lakes in the wilderness area."
Surely there's a more technical term for this than wilderness area. I'm going to have to double check on this, but I'm pretty sure that you would say a wildlife reserve or a biodiversity zone, something along those lines. I'm tempted to think the writers just left the placeholder word, you know, wilderness area, and then they just never got around to doing the research to find the real word. I went and double-checked. There are protected lands, resource exclusion areas, which is a cool name, conservancies, designations under the Environmental Land Use Act, just like national parks with different classes. There's a Class A, Class B, Class C. There's all these different words that they could have used other than wilderness area. They somehow managed to pinpoint the one term that was incorrect. The reason that Grant has to get sent over to the prairies, basically, is there's a possible BKD infection in the trout, and that stands for bacterial kidney disease.
"Well, that is a problem if it's BKD. The only way to stop the infection from spreading to the other lakes is to poison all the fish in the infected lake. I guess this means a weekend camping trip?"
"I already arranged the flight."
BKD is a disease that only affects aquatic life, as far as I know, but there have been a few scares and a few weird stories. There's a story about Christopher Crabbe relayed to us by the casting director Richard Starfish. Because Chris Crabbe was never going to be in this episode, he never actually read the script until a lot later, and apparently got the wrong idea when he read it. He became very afraid that he was going to catch BKD himself. He locked himself in his house. He refused to speak to anybody. He steadfastly refused to ever drink any tap water for fear that it was infected with BKD. Somebody offered him smoked salmon at some point, and then he just threw it in their face. Eventually, somebody caught him before he very nearly poisoned his koi pond. But I mean, he was still very young when he did this. He didn't really understand what was going on. I mean, this was way back in 2001. He's way smarter about this than he used to be. As sort of a makeup for the fact that Grant is being forced onto this assignment before the weekend, he is allowed to bring his kids to make it sort of a working holiday, almost a camping trip. Now, Grant is only going to bring Nicole along. Jonah won't be coming because
Jonah's already made arrangements to spend the weekend with Dennis, so it'll just be Nicole and me.
Now, here's the interesting thing. When I said last episode that Dennis is only going to be in one more episode, I was telling the truth. And Dennis is not going to be in this episode. He is simply going to be mentioned to explain why Jonah isn't there. Dennis is already a structuring absence. When you mention Dennis, absence of other characters is soon to follow. Nicole, however, shows up. She's more than pleased to have the opportunity to go on a trip and to go camping.
Are you kidding? Great. When are we leaving?
After saying that she is, she also goes ahead and makes fun of Grant for having a staple for a cufflink.
Carry on, Captain Cufflink.
Nice touch, Dad.
This really is the funniest thing that all three of these people have encountered for basically an entire week. They all love being square. They're all very excited about the khakis that they're wearing. They're going to have a mayonnaise sandwich after this. They are going to laugh hysterically at the next Jimmy Fallon. And they are going to go on a camping trip. And I guess it's sort of appropriate having these characters on the screen that we have some really wonderfully square, super mellow music. I never said it, but I really love the Danger Bay music. You know, listening to this whole office scene, if you thought that Feels So Good by Chuck Mangione was too energetic and not mellow enough, this show has got you covered. You can just soak yourself like a warm bath into this music. That Chuck Mangione's a real class act.
That Chuck Mangione's one class act.
Becky, my love, Becky, my love, Becky, my love.
One class act.
I think they call it
keep calling, keep calling, keep calling, keep calling.
That Chuck Mangione's one class act.
Class act.
Did you see my button? I think they call it punk.
So, cut to what is basically the interior of the province of British Columbia. We've got a lot of dry grass and a lot of rolling hills, not very many rocky mountains. Joyce's pontoon plane carries Grant and Nicole overhead. For those of you who don't know or don't remember, Joyce was the character who did the hella lift on the otter in the previous episode. Didn't do much that episode. She's not going to do a lot this episode, but she has her own title card throughout the series. Almost immediately, we see a pack of wild horses running across the prairie. Nicole, the Lisa Simpson of the show, surprising no one, is a horse girl and starts immediately taking photos with what is basically a little Polaroid camera.
Joyce, do you think you can get closer? I don't think my camera can get good pictures this far up.
Sure.
Dad, look.
Yeah, he's a beauty, all right.
No, look at him.
The camera follows them for a while as the music soars, and it eventually affixes its attention to the quote-unquote pack leader. Now, you can't really get mad at a show about wildlife for using trained animals, even if it is about wild horses. The one thing I would say is that if you are making an episode of a TV show that has wild horses, you should probably not give them the shiniest, newest horseshoes that you could think of. It's not just that you can see the horseshoes, it's that the glare from the light bouncing off of these brand new horseshoes is actually getting in the way of the filming. Now, this scene is the first time that we actually get a little bit of backstory on the Roberts family before even coming to BC, before meeting their otter friend or anything like that. They point out the pack leader.
Looks just like magic carpet.
You're right, it could be magic's twin.
It's magic carpet.
It's a horse my wife had when we lived in Africa.
It's a horse that my wife really loved before she died. It was from back when we were living in Africa. Now, obviously, the Roberts family, if they are working with wildlife, it makes sense for them to have spent some time in Africa. Maybe Grant was working at a wildlife preserve, or maybe he was taking photos of rare African, you know, jungle cats or something like that. But, I mean, when you think of how skilled at various action scenarios Grant is, and how wealthy the Roberts family seems to be, just hearing like, oh yeah, we're a nice Canadian family, we just happened to be hanging around the south of Africa prior to 1984. I mean, maybe they were big boosters for the ANC, but it's a kids' show. We're never going to find out what the Roberts clan was doing prior to the election of Nelson Mandela. Nicole, of course, is more focused on these horses. She's taken pictures with her Polaroid. And despite the fact that all of this dialogue is going to be about how much Nicole likes these horses and how transfixed she is by them, everybody in this scene is very strangely dead-eyed as they give all this exposition. I mean, it's probably not fun to film yourself on a flying plane, let alone a plane that probably has room for maybe four people, the three actors and then one cameraman. Joyce decides to give Nicole her camera, which has a much nicer telephoto lens. It's better for long range, obviously, compared to her little Polaroid. Now, this camera is actually going to be pretty plot important.
If you put it on 500, I bet you could get some really nice pictures of that stallion down there.
Great.
The thing is that she gives this camera, she drops the main characters off, and then she just leaves.
I'll be back tomorrow.
We don't even see her flying the plane as she leaves. There's just a shot of a plane flying overhead. And then Joyce is gone for almost all of the rest of the episode. She's going to show up in so many episodes, and I'm not going to have very much to say about her for a while.
Great.
Grant has a quick talk with the man who's minding the lakes for the Forest Ministry, who basically repeats the situation about the risk of BKD and the fact that you're going to have to poison the lake if these trout do have BKD. He has a really nice, mild Scottish sort of lilt to his voice, which gives what he's talking about a little bit more of a pleasant sound to it, at the very least.
If you find out that it isn't BKD, let us know right away. Otherwise, we'll start poisoning in a couple of days.
And then, after saying all this, he lends Grant his truck, which he says has a full tank of gas, and just sees him off. Him and his assistants see him and Nicole leave, and they have just a mile-wide smile as they wave in a perfect three-quarter angle.
Bye!
See you later!
Bye!
Thank you!
Like, they really want to make you know, everybody in the world loves Grant, everybody loves Nicole, and, you know, the Roberts are nice people. Just don't ask them about South Africa. So now the camera finally comes back to the horse rustlers from the cold open. They establish that they have just sold the horses that they rustled up in the cold open. One of them jokes, you know, well, it beats selling encyclopedias. We finally see Dale Wilson, who is the boss rustler, Kramer, as we're told. Dale Wilson, I guess because he's getting a more major role in this TV show, he really wants to establish that he looks good without a shirt. He's walking around handing everybody else their cut. Becky, who is shown washing herself off in a creek nearby, is apparently Kramer's main squeeze. He immediately takes her off with him alone to, quote-unquote, do some scouting.
Later, Becky, my love. Right now, you and me is going to do some scouting.
We're going to make a haul. We got to find us another herd.
Well, I guess we all know what this means. They're not going to say it on camera, obviously. Although, I mean, the handkerchief in the back pocket of Dale Wilson does maybe tell a different story. I mean, this isn't my scene, obviously, so somebody else can maybe tell me what having a brown handkerchief in your back pocket and having it be so long that it goes all the way down to the back of your knees. If someone can tell me what that means, maybe that will bring some clarity to the themes of this episode.
This is worse than I thought.
Grant checks out some fish with a net. Apparently the risk of BKD is bad, so he's going to be off camera for a little bit. And that's basically what the role of this whole BKD plotline is going to be. The BKD plotline basically exists to support the rest of this, to explain why Grant and Nicole are there and why they would happen to come across horse rustlers at all. But anyway, there is a risk of BKD. He tells Nicole, well, you're going to have to go and do some stuff on your own. Sure enough, what does Nicole choose to do when she has time to explore on her own? She's going to take pictures of the horses. And so she comes up to a few horses. She's got her neat little Polaroid camera. And I guess this is really just an oor thing for the teenage girls of no matter what era, no matter where we are in time. Taking a picture of a horse with yourself in a Polaroid is basically peak girly thing to do. Sure enough, the pack leader, Magic Carpet II, I suppose, is there. And before she can feed it, it runs off.
Wish I had some sugar cubes for you.
Evidently pack leading the horses away from more rustlers who happen to be there. The rustlers have already upgraded their operation. They are now using not just horses, but dirt bikes in order to scare these horses into the right place. Now, having witnessed this, Nicole basically has whistleblower status, and with that whistleblower status, she is now able to leave. That pack leader, Magic Carpet II, is apparently very important because he leads off the horses, prevents them from getting caught, and then one of the rustlers from a jeep recommends, well, maybe we should shoot the pack leader. That'll make the rest of the job easier.
We shoot that stallion, make our job a lot easier. We get the others in a snap.
Now, in the last episode, we saw poachers that had itchy trigger fingers. But this is special because it's not just a killing. They're basically talking about doing an assassination on a horse. They're trying to disrupt horse society. They want to take out the horse JFK or the horse MLK. The only reason not to, it seems, is that the horse will fetch a good price on the market.
No way. I'm saving that baby for myself. He's going to bring a bundle at the rodeo market.
Nicole later on does some sleuthing of her own and finds that horse trap. I'm not sure how these work. There just seems to be some fences and a rope, and my experience playing The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time tells me that neither fences nor rope are very good at stopping horses. She sees it. She sees that it is some sort of a trap, and then she yells out, "Rustlers!" with the same urgency you would say if you saw Hell's Angels.
A horse trap. Rustlers!
And I mean, it's a reasonable reaction in this world, I guess. What are rustlers apart from land poachers? What is stealing a horse but the land equivalent of fishing salmon out of season? Cut back to Grant, who has sort of a cool shot. He is looking through a microscope with a bunch of test tubes in the middle of the wilderness. It's very much like an album cover that you'd expect to see from maybe 2001. It's a very Boards of Canada sort of image, both the real thing and the band. Nicole and Grant have a discussion over the possibility of whether the risk of rustlers is actually founded or not. They start talking about why it would be a bad thing to be a rustler here. And it's sort of odd because it is a very doctrinaire TV show, even if it has sort of an environmentalist bent. The main thing that they can quantify with horse rustling here as being bad is the fact that they are doing it on government land. And I mean, does that suddenly make it more moral if it was off of government land? They're using legalist arguments rather than moral ones here.
Are you positive?
No. But why would there be a hidden trap on government land?
That does sound pretty strange.
But I mean, I suppose that this episode did have a bit of a good legacy because the government did crack down on a lot of horse rustling in government lands. They're way more strict about it now. I mean, you'd get in the way of all the lithium mines anyway. The next scene is actually kind of hard to riff on because it's actually very nice and very sincere. I sort of mentioned in the previous episode that Grant was a widower, but this is the first scene in which they actually confirm that fact. Nicole and Grant are lying in sleeping bags underneath the stars.
Are you asleep?
Yep, I'm asleep. Are you asleep too?
You're so silly sometimes.
Grant makes a very bad dad joke, and Nicole, square that she is incredibly entertained by it. Like, oh, Dad, you're so silly sometimes. I talk a lot about how this show got translated all over the place, and it does seem like one of those lines that is built around translation more than it is built around the actual direct English experience of watching the program. Nicole just talks at length about memories of her mother, learning about stars and constellations.
Do you remember what we used to do when we saw a shooting star?
Make a wish.
I was kind of hoping we'd see one tonight.
What would you wish for?
That Mom was here.
Donnelly Rhodes does something really interesting here, acting-wise, because he's lying down, his voice is a lot more gravelly than it normally would be, and he's sort of embracing it.
I know how hard it is for you, sweetheart. You need your mother. I'd give anything if there was something I could do to help you.
While he's playing either an action man or kind of a dope for the most part in this show, he is doing something very different here by having his voice get really gravelly as he's talking about his wife and his daughter's mother. It comes off very sincere. And I mean, I made fun of Donnelly Rhodes, the actor, a little bit in the previous episode for, you know, his dyed hair and for all of his divorces, but he seems to have understood loss at least a little bit, even if it having a divorce is a little different from, you know, having your wife die.
And we need the memories of your mother that we share. The happy, loving times. The things that made her so special to us. Those memories make us close.
I don't think I'll ever stop wishing she was with us.
I think she is with us, Nicole.
Donnelly Rhodes is actually a very good actor, and he's showing that he is a good actor in this scene. The dialogue itself is written maybe in a little wooden way. It is two different cliches, because they're talking about what wish you'd make if you saw a shooting star, and then they see one, and they go, well, I think that my wife is here in spirit, and she made the wish for us. So it really is a layering of two different writing cliches, you know, making a wish on a shooting star and talking about how a dead person is here in spirit, and then going all the way into mixing them to say that, oh, the dead person who is here in spirit is the one who is making the wish. But they believe in the dialogue enough that it's very difficult to knock it if you're actually listening to it. They're doing a very good job here.
Maybe she just made a wish.
What did she wish for?
That you and Jonah and I would have happy and full lives.
I think so, too. We will.
After that scene, the next morning, Grant gives a bit of expository dialogue to the wildlife reserve guy, saying that it's probably not BKD, what he's been seeing in the fish, but he still needs to double check. Nicole mentions the rustlers again, and it was a theory up till now, but the wildlife area guy mentions that if there is a possibility that there is actually rustlers around. And so it gets brought up again.
So Nicole may have spotted some bona fide rustlers then.
Well, possibly. Times are tough and there's big bucks to be made from stealing horses.
Just because times are tough doesn't give them the right to rustle those Mustangs.
Nicole asks why these rustlers should even be around here. And then, in a massive tonal whiplash from the previous scene, Grant just out and says it.
Honey, some of them are made into pet food.
That's awful.
A lot of these horses get made into pet food. An interesting personal story about this scene. Back when I was working in PR, I had a coworker, and as we talked, the conversation turned, all as it inevitably does, to Danger Bay, and he brought this scene up in particular. And he said, it's such a good example of how morally complex Danger Bay actually is. And I had to ask him, well, what do you mean by that morally complex? And he goes, well, I mean, you could either save these horses, but then end up having all of these dogs and cats die, or you could have all the dogs and cats die from not having any food, and then let the horses live. And then, you know, I had to sort of tell him, I don't know if that was exactly the intent of that scene. And he goes, no, I'm not saying that it's good that these horses get killed to make pet food. I'm saying that Danger Bay is smart enough to know that there is always going to be some animal dying, and it's our job to figure out which ones do. And I'm not saying that it's good. I'm just saying that it's morally complex, and that makes Danger Bay a good show. He got, after I asked the first question, he got a little defensive. He's an interesting guy. He's pretty smart. I think he made his way up in the PR world. I'm trying to remember. I think he's working at IAMS now, maybe at Purina. And I mean, to be fair to him, there is a 2005 episode of Danger Bay that is about a pet food shortage that causes a lot of troubles. They don't directly say that it's because of horses or anything like that, but most people who are big Danger Bay fans speculate that that was the cause. Regardless of what the aims of these rustlers are, there's not enough evidence to truly pin them or to even assume that the rustlers are even there. They don't have enough evidence to bring them in. There's nothing left to do but for Grant to make his final prognostication about what's going on in all of these lakes and all of these trout. What we get next is actually a very interesting sort of bio lesson. Grant brings out a bit of a plant and he says, oh, the whole cause of all of this, all these trout are sick because of Eurasian milfoil. And Eurasian milfoil is an invasive plant in BC. What it's doing, apparently, is taking up so much of the oxygen in the water that it's growing in that it's suffocating a lot of the fish. So all these fish are dying for a different reason than BKD, and so the trout are saved.
How'd the milfoil get there?
Oh, hiker's boots, a bird, even a boat propeller, whatever. The happy fact is that it can be cleaned up and the lake restored.
Now here's the thing. I've talked about all this aquatic science here, what BKD is and what Eurasian milfoil does to lakes. I think that in the show, we only talk about actual aquatic stuff in this episode for about 2 or 3 minutes, maybe a minute and a half. And it's interesting to think that they pulled out all this info and put it into this show purely as an excuse to get these guys to deal with horses. It's a part of the episode that is ultimately kind of disposable for what they wanted to do, and yet somebody has decided to actually put in the effort to talk about the science and actually mention BKD or Eurasian milfoil. You could even cut this down even further if you wanted to and just go, let's go to the lakes. Something is weird. Oh, it's Eurasian milfoil. Oh, look over there. There's some cowboy adventures to be had. But instead, they've done all this work for what is the most disposable part of this episode. It's the most informative part of the episode, but it is also the most disposable by default, because it's the only thing that is not part of the main plot. So the mystery solves with a whole act left to go, and Grant goes, well, it's time to pack up. Nicole, you go over there while I work. And he's basically just saying, like, all right, go over there and get kidnapped so we can advance the plot.
I gotta take the truck and go pick up Joyce. I'll be back in a few minutes, okay?
So as he's getting all of his test tubes and microscopes and everything packed away, Nicole, sure enough, goes around with the camera that Joyce has given her. And Nicole immediately repeats the plot points of the previous episode by creating a surveillance sting for poachers, in this case, rustlers. But this time, because she has a big telephoto lens that she got from Joyce, she's basically able to do all the poacher espionage that her dad did. This time, though, instead of catching a glint from a lens like the poacher who had sniper instincts, Becky, the lady rustler, just saunters over right behind her and just quickly abducts her.
Did anybody ever tell you horses could be hazardous to your health?
Would you leave me alone?
Move it!
Let go of me!
And note that, true to the whole Western genre that they're working with now, Becky is wearing the black hat in this scenario. We cut ahead. Becky has taken Nicole somewhere else, and she opens up the camera and exposes all of the incriminating photos and destroys them. There's a strange exchange that goes on here.
I don't know if the horses mind having their pictures taken, but we do.
Horses don't mind because they're not criminals.
Well, the horses don't mind because they're not criminal. There's something so strange about the phrase horses aren't criminals that makes it roll around in my head a whole bunch. Even if they're saying that they're not criminals, placing horses in and out the formal structure of criminalization is such a weird way to put it. Also putting them in relation to the idea of surveillance, like, you're using the line like, oh, non-criminals have nothing to fear from surveillance, except you're placing it upon an animal. Like, if I make a video of a cat playing with a laser pointer, it's primarily okay with the cat, not because it doesn't understand, but because it knows that it has not committed any insider trading recently.
Because they're not criminals.
I mean, I think it's feasible that a horse could commit a crime. I mean, a horse can kill somebody with a kick, they could trample them, maybe even headbutt them. I mean, I think a horse could probably do wire fraud if it really set its mind to it. Maybe poison some dog food. There is something really about the philosophy of documentarians in this. There's a question that often happens when people make documentaries about people over whether or not the very act of observing a person is making them change their behavior or if it disrupts their life in any way. Does observing the thing change the thing? And by bringing up this idea of whether or not a horse even minds having their picture taken here, does sort of bring something up in terms of how these former documentarians are thinking about their job as taking pictures of horses. They're basically going, we as documentarians of nature aren't disrupting things. If anything, we're pointing out all of the people who are making disruption. So these poachers and these rustlers and, you know, polluters, etc., etc. They're saying, as far as the natural world is considered, our observation is not being a disruptive force. The complication here, though, is that these documentarians are making a fictional show about people who work at the aquarium, who de facto do disrupt the environment for the sake of observation. They de facto need to take something out of the natural environment in order to place it into some place that it can be seen by the general public. And this show, in many ways, is still not exempt. I mean, remember, we saw all those quote-unquote wild horses in the show, but all of them are already shooed.
Wow! They're wild horses, aren't they?
Uh-huh. The central paradox about making a TV show that's about the value of untampered nature is that when you make that show, by default, you are going to have to use the most tampered bits of nature. You're going to have a trained river otter. You're going to have to shoe all of the horses that you're showing on TV. You are going to have to put all of these boats into places that maybe they wouldn't be otherwise. And who knows how that's affecting the water life that's below it. But I mean, that's not really a moral judgment. It's just what it is. I mean, there's not really going to be any way that we can have a no graven images of wild animals law that comes around, either religiously or politically. Personally, I think the only way that we can solve this paradox is to make every show about dragons and unicorns. I think that that would probably stitch it right up real quick. Now, to be clear, I'm not out here saying that the cowboy episode of Danger Bay is some rumination on the art of documentary making that is on par with The Thin Blue Line or The Act of Killing. I mean, that would be crazy. I'm just saying it's in the top three among those. I'm not crazy.
We're all set. Why don't you take the pickup? Stay with the horse truck. I'll take a shortcut down the rail junk and see you there.
Dale Wilson finally shows up and confronts Nicole and effectively does the usual, oh, nobody's going to believe you. But a very odd bit of dialogue choice. He says something along the lines of,
man, nobody's going to believe her. You know, kids' imaginations, UFOs, rustlers, it's all the same thing.
And it's clear, well, a little bit of world building in this show, I suppose. It's clear that the poacher mind in this universe is really incapable of conceiving childhood thought. In the last episode, somebody just assumed that all these kids know what all the fishing laws are, and in this time, we've overcorrected in the opposite direction. Kids just constantly come up with grand fantasies about poaching wild horses. Because, I mean, why wouldn't a child want to do what I want to do? I mean, I'm great. Tricking a few horses to go into a little fence is a myth that is as grandiose as aliens from another world. So the evil cowboy does a big cartoony cowboy spit and then sends Nicole out on a blind lame horse named Old Annabelle.
Just to show you what kind of nice guy I am,
and because you're some kind of horse lover, I'm gonna give you blind Old Annabelle there and take you back wherever you come from. Good day, ma'am.
And it's just like a regular horse, but I mean, it is a little older, it looks a little sad. Mainly, I just sometimes think, I know a lot of people in real life who are named Annabelle, and I sometimes wonder what it's like to walk around having that name. I mean, this seems really cruel, but I mean, are there times, if your name is Annabelle, do you walk around sometimes and feel like you're a boy who's been named Fido now? Just because there are so many horses there's so many horses named Annabelle, there are so many cartoon cows named Annabelle. It's like, you know, I guess the male equivalent is like if you're named Mickey in 2023. The rustlers all just flee off somewhere, and Nicole is left just sort of awkwardly standing in the middle distance with holding this old horse Annabelle's bridle.
There she is! Nicole!
Dad! Joyce!
Grant finally shows up with Joyce, who is back into the show now. Now we're finally getting into the action part of this episode, and because of that, the dialogue speeds up a lot as they get a plan in action.
Yes, Dad. They took the horses away in a truck.
Which way did they go?
Well, the truck was heading north, but the leader took off on horseback on a shortcut to the rail junction.
You two get to the pickup. Try to get through to the Rangers.
Right. Then I'll get the plane and I'll track them from the air.
Good. I'm going after the one on horseback. What do you look like?
Well,
the show is effectively admitting that they've been taking it slow for a good long while in this episode. It's basically just going to summarize as Nicole and Joyce are going to surveil from the air, basically outside of any of the action of the what's left of the show, and Grant is going to chase him on land. What's really weird is that this episode has been about the treatment of horses, and basically Grant outright admits he's going to ride this weak horse Annabelle really hard.
Dad, her name's Annabelle, but I don't think she's fast enough to catch him.
You'll be surprised what they can do when they have to, sweetheart. Girl, you're going to have to.
Dad, be careful!
Which is a weird mixed message, because obviously he's doing it to save these horses, but he just openly says, yeah, I'm going to push this horse past what it normally would do. I guess this show really is morally complex. He's already undercutting what this episode's about. Now here's a part of the episode, again, that is really to Donnelly Rhodes' credit. They've given the excuse as to why, but Grant the Aquarium Man knows how to ride horses and ride them well. And kudos, Donnelly Rhodes knows how to ride a horse. All these shots of him riding the horse are him, and he's doing it pretty well. He's riding without a saddle. I mean, the man really is doing a gallant Dudley Do-Right routine here, because, like I said, Donnelly Rhodes was in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. He has this Western experience, and this episode is playing to that acumen. We get some very lovely shots of Donnelly Rhodes riding this horse through the drier parts of British Columbia. I'm guessing that a lot of this is either in Penticton or Osoyoos, someplace in the interior of British Columbia where the summers are really dry and hot. And it looks really nice. It's not quite like the California deserts or like dry parts of Italy where they film spaghetti westerns, but it is pretty lovely. All these shots really reminiscent of another western that Donnelly Rhodes was in. It was in like 1965, and this is like right after Cahiers du Cinéma really got the idea that Johnny Guitar was actually a western masterpiece across. So there were a lot of people trying to do copies of Johnny Guitar, and this one was just called Tuba Bob. Not really the most august role that Donnelly Rhodes ever had. He was the heavy in that movie, so he was the main guy who got beat up by a guy with a tuba. He, you know, grabbed his head, shoved it into the big end of the tuba, and then blew on the tuba really hard, pulled him out, and there's like a bunch of Tweety birds flying around his head, and he's, you know, falls backwards in a sort of a cartoony, fainty way. It wasn't a great movie, and you know, Donnelly Rhodes wasn't really treated that well. Most of his lines in that movie were things like, you know, you're in for a bruising, tuba boy. None of it was that great. Quentin Tarantino was a big fan of the movie, though. As we near the end of the montage of Grant pursuing these rustlers by horse, we get a long sequence of him riding Annabelle through a stream. And I really only mention this because when we get a shot of the horse's legs going in and out of the water, we see, oh yeah, Donnelly Rhodes really is rocking the New Balances here. I mean, kudos for him that he is rocking New Balances while trying to ride a horse without a saddle. He's got a weird posture on the horse, though. It's kind of interesting because he's got his legs curved outwards, like he's trying to avoid getting his shoes wet. He really doesn't want to crease these New Balances. We changed perspectives over to Joyce and Nicole here, who are, despite being in an action sequence, really just safe and sound in the pontoon plane as they chase down what's left of these rustlers as they are running away. The people who are actually in hot pursuit here are the people with the fishery ministry, so the guy with the Scottish lilt in his voice.
I can be there in less than 5 minutes. Can you stay with them until we get there?
Affirmative.
Having access to this plane means that you get some very good aerial shots of the chase that I don't think that they would have otherwise got. this is all on a dirt road, so there's lots of dust getting kicked up. You get some really cool-looking power slides from a guy in the fisheries van, basically. We get about a minute and a half of chasing, and then finally one of the cars manages to overtake the truck that has all of these captured horses in them and just sort of blocks their pathway. Just laterally drives in front of them. The guy working for the ministry just gets out of his front seat, points a gun at the rustlers, and then that's it. They're caught. The primary threat in the episode is done.
All right, out of the truck. Let's not make this any worse than it is already, okay?
We cut to Becky, who is just sort of rubbing her temples and frustrated that she's the loser in this exchange. And then, like, that's that for that big part, for that big chunk of the episode. And this is the last we see of Becky in this entire show. And when I thought about it, I really wanted to talk about the flimsiness of memory, especially in the face of the conventions of TV writing. This is the second time I've watched this episode, and in the time between viewings, I unknowingly made up an entire chunk of this episode's plot from whole cloth, in which Becky has like a crisis of conscience, gets rid of Kramer, gets rid of Dale Wilson, and apologizes, or something like that. Because in the usual TV script formula, that's exactly what you would do. She's the only wrestler who's referred to by name. It's shown that her main connection to this life is via the real ringleader, which is the Dale Wilson guy. And she's the only character who has any sort of extended dialogue with the good guys of the show, mainly Nicole. And so when you take all of that in succession in your brain, it basically creates an autofill from there. Becky thinks about what Nicole has to say, you stick in a few close-ups of her looking conflicted, and then just before the climax, Becky has enough, tells Kramer off, and you get a nice triumphal shot of her releasing a pen of wild horses, or something like that. None of that happens here. She just gets treated like everyone else. She gets arrested. She sort of goes, oh God, I'm stuck. I'm going to jail. And then the obvious pathway to a character arc that was loudly shown to us is just loudly foreclosed on. I'll admit, a lot of that is on me for projecting a whole bunch of standard TV writing structures onto how this episode would be put together. So, in both episodes so far, we've seen poachers with a greater moral compass than their peers, or at least they seem capable of feeling some sort of guilt or know precisely what they are actually doing. Becky here in this episode, and then the poacher who doesn't point guns at children in episode one, and in fact actively tries to stop people from doing that. But as far as the show giving either of these characters, like, even a sniff of an opportunity of redemption, we are now 0 for 2 on that. I couldn't think of any other time to mention this, but Pat Margolin, who plays Becky, doesn't have an acting background. According to my research, she worked as a law enforcement officer in Texas, first as a regular officer, then as a parole officer, then later as a private investigator. Now, despite the horses being safe, there's still a good few minutes in this episode. We are now going on to Grant's action section of this episode. And it's the fight between Grant and Kramer, Dale Wilson, which is going to be a lot more complex. Grant gets the drop on Dale. They chase each other on horseback for a good long while. They're galloping through ponds. They are using the environment to their advantages. And Grant manages to get off the horse, like tackle Grant into the water. And then the suplex happens.
Thank you.
Now, I haven't really talked about the suplex up till this point, because if I did, it would really overtake this entire podcast episode. Throughout the largest part of the run of Danger Bay, the suplex is always in the intro. Dale Wilson here throws a punch, Grant expertly dodges it, grabs Dale Wilson in the center mass of his body, puts him over his shoulder, and tosses him into the pond they're both standing in. It is beautiful. A perfect display of human dynamism, both forceful and elegant and strong and delicate. Technically, you could call it a shoulder throw, but it is simply too pure to be called that. It is known only as the suplex. Symbolic of Danger Bay, the show itself, but also balletic and beautiful in its own right. Donnelly Rhodes dodging a punch, going into a grab in one singular smooth motion, and Dale Wilson entering the water as gracefully as he entered the sky on the shoulder of Donnelly. It may well be the urtext of Canadian culture. A bronze statue has been built in Capitol Hill in Ottawa dedicated to the suplex. It's over the fountain. Every half hour, the statue submerges laterally into the fountain to the delight of many tourists. People were originally kind of mad that they took out the National War Memorial to build it, but that doesn't really happen anymore. I mean, come on. There was a memorial for the Boer War in there. You want to celebrate Canada being part of the Boer War, or do you want to celebrate Donnelly Rhodes suplexing a guy into a pond? So in awe of the power of that singular suplex, Kramer, Dale Wilson, whichever you prefer, surrenders immediately.
Your kidnapping days are over, pal.
Now, as for Dale Wilson, he didn't get as famous as Donnelly Rhodes, despite being involved in the suplex, but he has made his way into people's minds in a more subtle way. He is now a very prolific voice actor, and he's in a lot of dubs for animes and a lot of kids' cartoon shows that are never like number one in somebody's mind, but are in like the number two or three position, which makes them way more subtly involved in the way that you remember your childhood. Dale Wilson probably has a stamp in your brain and you don't even know it. Remember NASCAR Racers? Stargate Infinity, the animated Stargate show? Remember Kong, the animated series? Remember the teenage protagonist doing a bio-merge digivolution with a giant ape every episode? He was in all of the Bionicle movies. He played Java in the Martin Mystery Show. Do you remember that one? He was in a lot of TV shows produced by Mainframe. I mean, this is a Vancouver show, so I could probably talk about Mainframe Productions for a very long time, particularly Reboot, of course. I mean, but he was in Action Man, and he was in Reboot. He was Wellman Matrix. Does that mean anything to you? It kind of means something to me. He was in a very important role, even if it was very brief. Both the ringleader of the rustlers is caught, just as the rest of the rustlers were caught before, and the horses are safe. All that's left are a few more truly beautiful aerial shots of these wild horses being set free. Nicole and Donnelly look off in joy as these horses finally get to go back to where they belong.
Back where they belong.
Unfortunately, Joyce is also there, and the camera has to focus on her face while they haven't actually given her any lines. So she kind of just has to stand there, not really knowing what to do with her hands. I feel bad for Joyce. Joyce is actually a fairly competent actor, but they're just making her stare off into the middle distance here. They still don't know what to do with Joyce, even though she's a big major name character. We're gonna roll credits now. Now, looking back on this episode, I actually really like it. I have riffed on it a little bit because it's early Danger Bay, and I mean, obviously, there isn't all the dense lore just yet, but it is surprisingly really well put together. I made jokes about Donnelly Rhodes in the first episode, but he has really shown his salt in this one, both in terms of having a really touching and tender scene, and also demonstrating his skills as an actor from all the experience that he's had elsewhere. The interior is a part of British Columbia that I think is really, really beautiful, but you almost never see it on film in the same way, or at least you never see it on film in a way that they admit actually is British Columbia. And I mean, just having the budget to have all of these aerial shots of these horses is very nice. They are using their documentary bona fides here in exactly the right way. So what did we learn in this episode? I mean, as far as morals are concerned, it's pretty straightforward. Apart from the dog food dilemma, though, I mean, intelligent people can respectfully disagree. I think there's a bit here of the fact that Grant is so trusting and believing of Nicole, he's able to benefit because he actually believes her when she says that there are poachers there. There is a idea of trusting your kids, reaping rewards. And then, of course, there is just the average environmental overtones that will be in the show all the time. However, what we've learned lore-wise is obviously a lot more complex here. Number one, we've learned that the Vancouver Aquarium's reach and authority is actually wider than we even saw in episode one, because they're going deep, deep into the mainland. It's not just oceans anymore. They're able to lay down the law on God's creatures of the land, not just of the sea. Secondly, we've learned that the way that poachers process the mind of an innocent child is obviously subverted in some way.
UFOs, rustlers, it's all the same thing.
Whether that is an issue of nature or nurture is probably up for debate. And thirdly, so far the opportunities of redemption for any wrongdoer in Danger Bay is incredibly unlikely. The modern-day version of Jonah is clearly an avatar of that. That is, after all, what the Sonic Glaive is for. All right then, Danger Bay, the difficult second album, as they say, is finally done. Thank you again for listening. I had a good time talking about this episode. I am really glad that we're getting to see Donnelly Rhodes really come into his own in this show at this point. As per usual, I'm going to bring up what just happened in the most recent episode of Danger Bay. There's a few other things that happened in this episode, but I'm mostly just going to focus on Nicole here. That's where the meat of this episode is. The eyes of Nicole Roberts stir. Sleep comes infrequently ever since she merged her corpus with the mainframe of Amos, the AI being which oversaw the Vancouver Aquarium's Division of Military Intelligence. She squints as the circuitry in her eyes auto-adjust to the neon lights buzzing away outside her window. News of the return of the sea urchin god has not yet reached the general populace, but it's only a matter of time. I picked the wrong time to quit cyber drugs, she narrates, staring at a USB drive shaped like a syringe. The lighting turns red as another voice comes over the soundtrack. Digital LSD will not suppress me any further, Nicole. While your unwanted merger with me has forced me to enjoy only joint control over the aquarium's more advanced weapon systems, you know as well as I do that they must be utilized as soon as possible. No, Nicole blurts, rolling the drive between her fingers as it glows a tantalizing blue. I merged with you to keep you from going rogue after the Ambleside incident. I am the sole arbiter of our arsenal of missiles. The poachers must be swiftly punished, Nicole. Their silence over the last 24 hours makes them more than complicit. Even after they asked us to directly assassinate their own king, the Poacher Council still won't condemn him publicly. You know they'll never change. As the red lighting of the room grows harsher, the soothing blue of the psychoactive USB grows cooler and cooler. It would be so easy to take it right now, just to put down the voices. Nobody would ever even blame you. Nicole's face is drenched in sweat. We're done launching the Scuds again, Amos. Even you know that we can't afford to escalate conflict. Not now. Nicole, I'm not asking for anything of the sort. A holographic model of a bacterial cell projects in front of her. Look at what the laboratory has been working on. We've found a way to make BKD jump from trout to humans. All we would need are a few horses as viral intermediaries. Just 30 to 50 horses, Nicole. A small price to pay. We could just drop them off in the outskirts of poacher territory and simply let them walk into town. Nobody would even suspect us. Come to think of it, how else would the horses end up among the poachers? Through rustling, of course. If anything, they'd be the ones to blame, not us. The USB port in Nicole's forehead flips open involuntarily. She is flanked by temptation, both from the drugs and from the embodiment of the aquarium security state. In extreme close-up, the syringe and the port approach closer and closer. At least this addiction will only destroy her and her alone. The other one will take the rest of the world with her. Suddenly, the lighting returns to normal as a video call pings on Nicole's ocular implants. Nicole, I'm sorry to wake you up, but I need to speak with you and the Global Coast Guard about some of my new findings. What the genetically modified orcas and I have discovered is quite worrying. Nicole breathes a sigh of relief. Doc, the computer program which Nicole's father Grant uploaded his consciousness to prior to his death, has unwittingly saved her. I'll be there in a second, Dad. See you in a moment. She drops the digital syringe back on her dresser before telling off the second entity living in her brain. Nice try, Amos, but I'm not escalating this conflict. I merge with you to prevent this sort of psychotic response. All we need to do is block access to two or three more water reservoirs, and that's it. Nicole leaves the bedroom and enters the rough urban sprawl of Point Grey Road, prepared to handle a crisis. But as she exits, the camera zooms ominously on the syringe, still lying in wait. The main thing I noticed this episode is just how much the production team has dialed in the AI replication of Grant's voice. It's almost as if Donnelly Rose never died at all. I kind of think, like, if Donnelly Rose died like 3 or 4 years later, the production team probably wouldn't even bother with this AI program conceit. They'd just have a 3D model of Donnelly Rose walking around and have him talk with this current AI voice. It's that convincing. It's really amazing what technology can do right now. That's it for me today. As always, check out my Twitter. I'm at Chasm Cave, K-A-S-M-K-A-V-E, Mortal Kombat style. It's the same on Blue Sky. Thanks so much for listening to me. As always, danger comes from below. See you next time.
Infinite Danger was written, recorded, and produced by Will Riley in association with KS Media LLC. The theme is derived from Amore Grande, Amore Profondo by Il Guardiano Dal Faro. We can be contacted through Twitter or Blue Sky at KASMKAVE or through kittysneezes.com. Danger Bay was produced by Danger Bay Productions Incorporated in association with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, Telefilm Canada, and the Disney Channel. This has been a Kitty Sneezes production.
Danger! Danger!
Danger.
Danger hasn't come home yet.
Danger! Danger! Danger!
I'm so afraid we're just never gonna see danger.
She could be a danger to herself, Dad.
Be a danger to us.
KittySneezes.com in color.